Hey guys, I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, this week we are diving headfirst into fall because it is fall, and we are psyched about this. And we have on Andy Baragani and Chris Morocco to discuss their big feature in the September issue of Bon Appetit, the Fall Playbook, 7 amazing recipes that you will be cooking all season long. And then after that, we are serving up the second installment of our Test Kitchen team's top 10 cooking rules, this time with Chris Morocco. In case you miss it, each one of our Test Kitchen editors will be on for the next several weeks talking about the techniques they swear by, the ingredients they can't live without, and the drive that keeps them going. All right, here we go. Guys, it's 88 degrees right now and like 109% humidity.
So gross.
But we're going to pretend it's fall.
Right. That's what we do, isn't it?
We always pretend that it's some season that it's not over here.
At least in the print world.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Because we're talking about the fall playbook from the September issue of Bon Appetit.
It really should have been the whole issue, but we'll talk about that later.
Wow. Andy's got an issue.
Andy's got an issue.
He has an issue with the issue. Chris, do you remember when this story is being conceived and you and Andy and I were talking about what this story could or should be? What was the mission? What did we sort of decide upon?
We wanted to get into sort of like get people into the mindset of like, okay, like summer is over, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. Like we want people to be excited to get back into the kitchen and, you know, just give them like some recipes that are kind of simple, uncomplicated, whether it's something that cooks quickly, but is kind of hands off, you know, or some combination of maybe it's a longer cook time, but like with zero prep, just give people an excuse to feel great about cooking again.
Getting back in the kitchen. And mm-hmm. I think one phrase that I think I might have bandied about is the notion of situational cooking.
Absolutely.
Because I think that dictates a lot about what we make when. Is it Sunday when you've got all day to sort of braise something in your Dutch oven? Or is it Tuesday night when you want to eat something good, but it's 6:28 p.m. and you haven't started cooking yet?
Right.
And I think that's in a lot of ways we sort of approach these recipes, of which there are 7 recipes, Andy?
I believe so. I believe 7. One of the recipes got cut. So.
Oh, yeah. Which one got cut?
I don't think it
got cut. It was designated to become a digital exclusive.
Yeah. It didn't look the right part.
Which one was it?
It was the lentil bowl.
The lentil bowl.
I know. Well, I don't think it was called that. I think it was like
a
warm
crispy
lentil
fried
salad with a spice chili oil, and then it was just like, I'm just gonna call it a lentil bowl for now because it got cut.
I think we realized that people only want to work so hard on a lentil bowl.
That's true.
And it took a little bit of doing.
Yeah. I don't know, but I know I do get excited like that notion when there's fall. There's a little bit of bite in the air, and summer's over, and summer is great. Going to the beach, grilling, all that. But it's nice to actually just get serious about wanting to be in the kitchen, pulling out your cast iron skillet, pulling out your Dutch oven, getting your tongs and cooking again.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And having the patience to really think about what ingredients, I mean, you should be thinking about your ingredients year round, but really putting the time in for cooking the dish you want to be cooking.
The first recipe, this is a Morocco recipe, right?
No, that was Andy.
Oh, gosh.
You should guess.
I know, this is
very interesting. Okay. He's got a guess for all that.
This is pasta, so of course it's Andy. I want to eat this just by the title. Creamy pasta with crispy mushrooms.
Yes. I wanted to come up with the pasta dish. I've done so many over the last, I think, almost 4 years here. But I don't think I've really done a creamy pasta dish with mushrooms. I love pasta. I love mushrooms. So I was like, this makes sense. And it feels very fall. And I thought this could come together fairly quickly. And that was my approach going in.
And we do a lot of creamy pasta from the standpoint of, oh, you know, glossy, emulsified, you know,
butter,
pasta water. Yes.
But I was like, Andy, just put cream in the pasta. You know how you make creamy pasta sometimes? If you want to like move fast and, you know, not break things, like, just put cream in the pasta.
Oh, my
it's
left
delicious.
Eye started twitching when he said this. I was heavy cream.
I was like, Andy, make it delicious. Come
I don't
on.
Know how many recipes I have that call for heavy cream, but in this case, I did go for it, and it really did make a difference. It just made it easy. It was like a nice little thing, crutch to use.
I mean, ultimately, when you blend heavy cream and then throw some Parmesan cheese, it is so good.
It's so good.
It's that the problem with it, it's literally one of those types of pastas that you can't stop eating. And it's like, you don't want to see a calorie counter as you're going, but it's amazing. Sorry. So this one, My question is, we can use either just simple crimini mushrooms you can find at any market, or you can go to the farmer's market and splurge on a lot of interesting wild mushrooms mm-hmm. that introduce different flavors and textures. I guess the question I always have when, and I love a mushroom pasta because it feels very autumnal. Mm-hmm. How do you cook the mushrooms themselves so they get nice and browned and caramelized and crispy before, you know, blending with the cream and all that? Because I feel like sometimes I get mushroom sometimes pasta and it's kind of just squeaky and squishy and, you know. But what's the technique?
So sometimes you're using a lot of mushrooms, in this case we're using a pound of mushrooms, you really want to do it in batches most likely. I like tearing my mushrooms up. A lot of us do that, and you end up getting these kind of craggly pieces, and so they get brown.
Because also when you cut them up, they end up looking like canned mushrooms sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just don't look right. I like kind of tearing them to their kind of natural shape. And then I cook them in oil, in this case extra virgin olive oil. And then I just go pretty hard, undisturbed, until they're brown around the edges.
So they develop a crust.
Yes.
Until flip them over.
Yeah, I give it a little bit of a toss. I don't even know if I really flip. I'm flipping each individual mushroom.
One of like if you work in the line in a restaurant, you don't have time to flip. You're just shaking. I think I read somewhere, it might have been Bon Appetit, that when you want mushrooms to develop a nice caramelized crust, you don't add salt till the very end because the salt draws out too much moisture. Is that correct?
Yes. I don't season my mushrooms until both sides are deeply browned and crispy and lacy around the edges.
Yeah, and also some shallots. I love that smell, like when you get the shallots. Shallots. Is there garlic in there?
No, there's no garlic.
No, but there is shallots. Yeah, but the shallots and sort of introduced stuff.
Pretty classic.
Yeah. And then you get all the mushrooms done.
Add the shallots. And the shallots, you're not trying to get too much color. You're just softening them. And then while you're doing that, you have the mushrooms ready to go. They're cooked. The shallots are going. You cook your pasta, and you're going to cook it just under al dente, like 2 minutes before. And then I add the pasta, the heavy cream, and let that go until the cream has reduced slightly. And then I add a bit of zest and juice from half a lemon.
Ooh,
there's a lot
of because the cream is so heavy.
Well, you have cream, you have butter, and you have Parmesan here.
Yeah,
so there's quite a bit of fat, and you have extra virgin olive oil. So you need a bit of zest and juice. You need that acidity, kind of brighten things up and bring everything back to life again.
Yeah, a couple of tips here. Love the pulling the mushrooms apart, but shredding the mushrooms by hand,
tearing the mushrooms by hand. Yeah,
I love not salting the mushrooms till after they're nice and browned. And then thirdly, what you guys in the test kitchen seem to love to do is use a Dutch oven when you're sort of like tossing the pasta with whether it's mushrooms or any sort of sauce it's high enough size you can toss and swirl and get everything incorporated.
It's such a good little insurance policy for being able to really work the pasta around. And like, let's face it, even just 12 ounces, never mind a pound of pasta in the largest skillet you own, it's flying everywhere.
It's not going to work.
Yeah. You're like bringing it over to the sink to like try to toss the pasta over that so that you don't get it all over your stove.
Okay, I'm going to bet that... God, this is all right. This is a lot
Should
of
we say what
here.
Is the next one? It's called sweet and saucy pork chops.
I'm going to bet Chris Morocco developed this
one. Yeah.
It just feels like a kind of a dad comes home from work, needs a quick meal for his family, sort of. Honey, I'm going to pick up some pork chops on the way home. Okay. Am I right?
Oh, my God. All right. Wow. That's how you really see me. I'm just like hunched over like the plate of pork chops, like not talking to anybody on a Tuesday.
What I love, this tip, so you have two, like hopefully buy some good bone-in rib pork chops, but you call for 1-inch thick ones, so they cook really quickly, but so you don't have to overcook them. You add some sugar to like a sort of a marinade, dry rub, whatever, so they get a quicker caramelized crust.
Yeah, just salt and a sprinkle of sugar on the pork chops. Because the thing is, pork chops, in a perfect world, we all be buying like pasture-raised heritage breed pork, and it would be super fatty and rich and unctuous, you know, just whatever you do to it. But this is kind of optimized to work with any pork chop. This is like, you know, and this is a method of cooking them that really mitigates like that tendency to have them dry out and get like really kind of like cardboardy. So adding that little bit of sugar to the outside means you're going to get crazy amounts of color within just a few minutes. so you don't need to overcook that first side in order to get the color you want. And that is like the death of like the 1-inch thick pork chop. You know, like we went back and forth about what pork chop to use because, well, all of a sudden you kind of want like a much fatter one in order to get like a really great crust, you know, without using sugar. But this just like lets you get that really quickly. And then you're really just, you're cooking that second side very briefly.
Can I just interject? That's something with any piece of protein, one side is always going to get more done than the other. And that side that gets the beautiful crust, that's the side you serve up.
Right.
What's going on underneath doesn't really matter.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the old sort of old school French, like, you know, approach, which is like you have the presentation side. And then like, who cares what the second side looks
and
like?
And then you make a super yummy, super easy pan sauce with some red wine vinegar that sort of introduces acid, some capers, butter, and then just some garlic mm-hmm. and the water, and then some rosemary, and it all swirls together.
Yep.
And you serve it. And it's probably, how long is it, start to finish, how long does this dish take? It'd be really quick.
15 minutes, barely.
If that, right?
If that, yeah. I mean, 12. So yeah, it's great. You know, like that kind of like that wet cook, you know, kind of environment just like means like nothing's going to dry out.
I also think when people see like some like pan sauce, they're very impressed. It's like, no, that's just like cooking the pan and throwing a bunch of other ingredients in there mm-hmm. afterwards. Speaking of pans, when I saw the photo for this sheet pan potato hash with fixins, and it was this beautiful sheet tray of these beautifully like shingled potatoes that are oven crisp, it looks like homemade potato chips. I was like, oh my God, that looks so good. The question is, which one of you developed this? Chris Morocco.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. No, it was me.
This is.
I'll take it.
This is not. Andy doesn't do brunch. If he does do brunch, he's not doing potatoes.
It would have been like
I'm a gay who doesn't brunch.
Yeah.
Andy's protein smoothie.
Yeah, he's busy working out on Sunday morning. He's not doing brunch. This is like this is a very dad move, like making brunch for the family.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, potatoes. You can make them as complicated as you want, or you can make them as simple as you want. And this is just a great way to take a lot of potatoes and make them unbelievably crispy, jammy, chewy, just everything you want.
So big russet potatoes, you don't even peel them.
No.
Thinly sliced, do you use a mandolin or can you slice them by hand?
Slice by hand because honestly, the irregularity, like it's going to be totally...
I like that because then some get extra crispy, some are a little tender. Yeah.
And that's fine. And the oven, these are going to be in the oven for close to an hour, you know, and you're going to get some that are like crazy crisp, like a potato chip. And others are just going to be, you know, more in the center. They're going to be a little bit like kind of chewy, jammy, but ultra tender.
Slice them really thin, toss them with olive oil, spread them out on a sheet tray. It's about 2.5 pounds, 425, yep. mm-hmm. 40 to 50 minutes. And it almost looks, when you take it out, it almost looks like a tray of nachos. It's like potato nachos.
It's like the love child of like Palm Anna, you know, where you have like the like clarified butter, like beautiful kind of like fanned out sort of shingly potatoes.
Did you go to cooking school?
I did.
I did this video with Molly Boz, maybe you know her, where we were talking about cooking school. And the next we have a video coming out on, what is it on? It's on, broccoli bolognese people were talking about. You were in that video. She was rolling her eyes so much about cooking school. Like why anyone would even bother to go to cooking school? The attitude, the shade she was throwing.
Oh, I don't know about that. I did not go to culinary school, but I don't think there should be any shade thrown.
I'm not saying there should be. I'm just saying Molly was throwing.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I think there's certain things you learn that like you would have to work in a very specific kind of restaurant to get that knowledge by other means, you know? And it's not a bad thing, but
I don't know. Maybe,
Molly thinks she has nothing left to learn. Have you met Molly Boz before?
We have.
Okay, so you got this beautiful shingle tray. Then are there options? But then you serve it. How do you serve this? You just take a chunk of the potatoes on a plate, and then you put, what do we put it on top of them?
Yeah, so I like a crispy fried egg.
Yes.
You know, that's kind of like one of my moves. Like, I'll use this, honestly, as a side dish for dinner as well. When you're doing, like, kind of roast chicken for a crowd, like, I'll do these kinds of potatoes on the side, you know?
Nice, okay.
Because
you can throw them in the oven with the chicken.
Exactly.
Genius.
But yeah, I love like a crispy fried egg, like a little bit of trout roe or salmon roe, you know, like get that kind of like, you know, like a kind of like s'more abroad kind of vibe, kind of toppings, like a little bit of dill, like some raw onion, all that, like a scoop of yogurt. So good.
Or because you fancy and you went to cooking school, it calls for creme fraiche. It's so funny. I work here at Bon Appetit, but I did not even think of these as a side dish for dinner.
No, I mean, I think they could definitely work. They're so delicious.
Yeah.
Okay, we go. Oh, man. All right. Coconut milk braised chicken. So these beautiful sort of caramelized brown chicken legs, then braised slowly in coconut milk, calls for Thai curry paste, lemongrass stalks. Who did this one?
Whole chicken legs.
Yeah, whole chicken legs. I'm going to say Andy Baragani.
No,
that was
me. Shoot, you were my first guess, but then
Andy made you, you doubt it.
I know. Why did you
like
do
whole
that?
Chicken legs? What does that even mean? Yeah, they're freaking whole chicken legs.
Well, I know, but I feel like I've done a lot. I've had to fight. We've both had to fight that battle.
Yes, that is true. That's
does
true.
Anyone else out in podcast land get annoyed when you get the chicken where the thigh is attached to the leg and you've got to cut through it and find your way around the bone? Wouldn't you rather just have like the thigh and then the drumstick separated?
Here's the thing though, with this dish, you want them together because this is like, this is when you take the dark meat of the chicken past the point of doneness into the realm of like shreddy tenderness.
I love shreddy.
So that, like
so
this
it just
is,
pulls
so,
right off.
Right. So and you can when you flex that joint between the drumstick and the thigh, I know. Yeah. But you know, that tells you if it flexes easily, you know, and you don't get the resistance anymore, then you know, okay, this is like giving it up, it's shreddy, it's tender, it's gonna be delicious.
So this one you're essentially browning the chicken and then you're making
You're combining the curry paste with the coconut milk with the chicken. Okay, in a roasting dish, you're throwing in some aromatics, your ginger, your garlic, your lemongrass, and you're just roasting it. And you're spooning over the juices. Yeah, just uncovered. You know, spooning over the juices every once in a while. The coconut milk, you know, the sugars, they really help kind of transmit that heat, you know, from the oven. So you get, you're still able to get this level of browning.
The color is amazing.
You know, with all that caramelization. And you're just letting time do the work. This is like, you know, you're going well over an hour. Not well over, but like 70, 75 minutes, you know, you could do. Again, just stressing the fact that like with dark meat, when you take it to the point where everything's just kind of shredding apart and super tender, it's just, for me, it's so much better.
I really want this. And you serve it with some lime wedges, some fresh cilantro, some little coconut chips.
So good with rice.
I mean, I could also just pie a pack of chicken thighs and do it. Chicken thighs, of course.
And like Amanda Shapiro, you know, she did like even like big wedges of like kabocha squash, you know, kind of in this mixture. It's just like, it's a good technique. You know, you could do like big firm vegetables with it. You could do, yeah absolutely.
And just some like jasmine or basmati rice.
Absolutely.
God, I really want this. Okay, that was my first. I can't believe I missed that last one. Okay, I'm going to jump ahead. I'm going to jump ahead to roast fish with curry butter. This strikes me as a very Baragani, Ignacio Matos type dish.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He's bringing both of us in. Yeah. Why do you say that?
Matos, because he likes like just things that are just very white and simple in that way, but then introduce them to different flavors to the equation.
I do like things just having that like one color going on, just white dishes, green dishes, and this is not my dish.
God.
Sorry.
Chris, why are you copying Andy? Why are you copying Andy? You know what they says though? It says you guys are part of a team.
Yeah,
it's a team. You play together.
Well, you know what's so funny? This started out as like, this was going to be like a whitefish poached in like an aromatic tomato broth that like, sometimes you just cook your way into a corner and you can't cook your way out of it. So I pivoted and ended up doing this approach, which for this, I honestly think is better. But what's hilarious is Andy has now, for Healthy-ish for this next month, he's now doing like, you know, flaky white fish in like a kind
tomato
of
tomato curry.
And then you also did the flaky white fish back in the
Feel
spring.
Good food plan.
No, in the magazine with for the garlic primer. Remember
that
super white on white? That's a gorgeous
one.
No one
will ever make it, but I love that dish.
I'll make it. So this one, big piece of fish. You call for a 1 1/4 pound of cod, hake, haddock, or pollock. So it's a big roast. So you've got a bed of onions, potatoes, all sorts of stuff
fennel,
in there. Fennel.
The whole idea is that you're giving the hard vegetables a head start here, right? So like everything's not going into this dish at the same time.
Okay.
You're giving your harder vegetables a head start, letting them roast, I think, you know, something like, 35, 40 minutes. and you could do anything there. Big wedges of squash, you know, you could skip the potato, you could do like, you know, fennel, only fennel with like, you know, one other thing, whatever. Do what you want. But point being, the fish goes on after the vegetables are basically cooked.
Okay.
You drop the temperature of the oven, so the fish can then cook through very gently on top of that bed
of
vegetables.
How long does a large piece of fish like this perhaps
take? Only going to take maybe 12 minutes.
Really? To sort of slip apart mm-hmm. and pull apart tender.
Because it's going on to a warm bed of mm-hmm. vegetables, and it's honestly, like, even a relatively large piece of fish like that, it just does not take long.
Yeah.
And that's like a really gentle treatment for it, because this is not like, you know, a slow roast salmon or, you know, or like a really fatty type of fish, you know, where you can kind of overcook it and it's still okay. You just want to be super gentle with it.
All right, I'm going to wager $50 that during the recipe development process for this story, Carla Lolly Music raised the issue that you had curry paste in the coconut milk braised chicken and curry powder in the roast fish with curry butter.
Well, in our defense, you know, this is like much more of...
Wait, did she raise this issue?
I think we knew we had an issue, just that Andy and I left to our own devices. We could either like go 100% like pan Mediterranean, or like 100% Asian.
100%
influence.
Asian. Yeah.
It had like something Asian in every single thing.
This is not a knock on Carla Lolly Music, but as the food director, she is vigilant about there not being any repeat sort of flavor profiles, ingredients mm-hmm. in an issue.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we already have chicken thighs over here. We can't use them again. And part of me is like, good point. And then sometimes like, you know what? This recipe is really good. Let's just go with it. Who cares?
Yeah.
I think we did a pretty good range with the recipes.
In the end, I think we really did. Like, we pulled in from a lot of different influences. Like, your braised short ribs are so different.
You gave it away.
Oh,
that was coming up next. So these chili...
There's still another one.
Would
you
have guessed me, though, for this one?
I don't know what to guess anymore. Again, you guys are in such lockstep these days. Like, what's interesting, in all seriousness, for the listener, you know, for typical stories, we have a recipe editor develops a particular story. So Andy did that garlic primer several months ago. Chris, what's the last magazine story you did?
God. Future grilling issue.
Yeah. So, and oftentimes with those stories, the editor is able to make those stories very much from their point of inspiration. This one was a little bit more of a team mission here, and you guys were tagging up, and it was also like, it was very like from the editors of Bon Appetit, as mm-hmm. opposed to from Andy Baragani or Chris
And I think
Morocco.
Andy and I, in fairness, are uniquely well-suited to collaborating in this style. Like, we work together on the same island. We think in different ways,
literal,
but in complementary
literal
ways.
Literal island. You're not talking like a figurative
literal
Station
island.
Station three.
Okay, this is make this when it's Sunday and you're not leaving the house. There's a few things I like better than on a brisk Sunday than having short ribs in the oven. The house smells amazing, and you're like, I can just hang out. And I it's just get smelling better and better, and you run out to get something from the store, and you come back and you open the door, and you're like, oh, God, it smells so good. So talk about the inspiration, the profile of this. I know how to make braised short ribs, but I often kind of make the typical same cooking school red wine version.
So I wanted a braised short ribs that I can get some kind of veg in there. So there is squash in this. And I wanted it to be more saucy. You know, I wanted it to be a saucy short rib dish. I didn't want it to be too brothy.
You mean like its attitude? You wanted
saucy? Yeah, kind of like me. This is like if I was like a slow braised dish, it would probably be this. In this case, you have short ribs. I got like the nice thick 2-inch by 2-inch pieces. You brown
them. Bone in.
Bone in.
Yeah.
Always.
That just helps the broth and everything a little bit richer.
For the broth, it helps them retain the shape. I guess they're not going to really fall apart mm-hmm. if you don't have the bone, but the bone adds nice body and flavor.
And in terms of flavor profile, what direction did you head on this one?
I kind of wanted to go a little bit more smoky, warm spices. I used dried chilies here.
Did you call Bobby Flay for advice on this one?
I don't know who you're talking about.
Never heard of him? He's a chef. He's got this Southwest thing happening.
I was in a video with him a while back. Do you remember that?
Which one was that? That was when he came in to become editor-in-chief?
fried onions.
The fried onion rings.
Oh, the fried onion in the yes. cafeteria. Oh, yeah,
like my second month here.
We were just like, hey, Andy, do this video against Bobby like, Flay.
This is weird.
You got to Google that, everybody. Yeah, Bobby Flay, Andy Bergotti.
So I wanted to be a little bit spicy, warm spices. So I went with dried chilies. I called for guajillo or ancho chilies, but I think any kind of medium spice level whole chili would work. You soak those. And then for the aromatics, I use onions and garlic, and I put them under the broiler until they're deeply charred. Mm. This is just like sliced onion rounds and garlic that is not peeled. You don't want them peeled, otherwise they're going to burn too much. And then I just pop the garlic out of the cloves, the onions blended with the chilies that's been soaking, and you have this like charred, smoky chili broth, and that's what you're braising the short ribs in, along with the spices, red pepper flakes for a little bit more heat, coriander, cumin, cinnamon, a little bit of tomato paste, that's in body and acidity and color.
And I like that you serve it with a dollop of Greek yogurt, which is, it kind of then reminds me of like when you get a bowl of chili and there's sour cream on there.
Yeah, I mean, I think typically it would make sense you could serve it with sour cream, but I think knowing me or if you've cooked any of my dishes, like I tend to go for yogurt. It just has a little bit more tang. There's already enough fat going on with the short ribs. You have the sweetness from the acorn squash, so I think a Greek yogurt.
Meanwhile, I'm going to
really
text
well.
Carla again because on this dish, atop the chili braised short ribs, there
cilantro.
Is cilantro and there's a lime. There's also cilantro on a lime on the coconut chicken. Did Carla see this story?
I think you got to talk to Carla.
She's gonna lay into you guys. Okay, last recipe, not counting the, I don't want to say the sad lentil bowl, but you know, the digital exclusive lentil bowl. This is the one, I want this dish so badly. The beef and ginger stir fry. I know it sounds almost, I don't know if basic is the right word, but it just looks so glazed in those sweet onions and the shredded, like the stir fried beef and, oh, God, I want this. Andy Bergotti?
First of all, I've never, ever heard the word basic associated with me, so please take that back in regards to my dish. But yes, this is me. Beef and ginger stir fry.
It's beef and onions. It's deliciously basic.
Yeah.
But it's also...
But why does it look so good? That's what I don't understand.
It's influenced from a complete different direction.
Okay, what is... Meaning what?
Like, I think you were riffing on, like, the Filipino dish, bistec.
Yes,
which is,
exactly.
like, the simplest... It's like not even a stir fry. It's like kind of like it's pieces of, you know, like it could be any cut of beef. And then it's like finished with soy sauce, lemon. There's usually like a lot of like big chunky pieces of onion. Sometimes there's bay.
So and Chris did a version with this with Angela, formerly from Mission Chinese. Now she's at the Standard doing some great stuff over there.
Yeah.
Yes. And I remember seeing this dish. This was December 2017,
yeah.
When we did the holiday story
with
Angela
with her.
And her Filipino Christmas out in California with her family.
Yeah. And
really
cute nephews. And I remember seeing this dish and I'm like, this looks cool. So this was a combination of seeing what they did and then also just my deep love for like the occasional takeout, like beef takeout. Mm. And I just knew I wanted a handful of ingredients that you could make, that you'd always have. Ginger, some onion, soy sauce.
Butter.
I feel like butter is the secret ingredient. No, you say this. You say that butter is my secret ingredient. I don't think anybody would say,
You were adding, on this other podcast, you were adding butter to a no-cooked tomato sauce.
Yeah,
that's
true. It needed.
I know. I'm just saying, you, for someone who didn't go to French cooking school, you're very generous with the butter.
Yeah, I think it needs it. In this case, it adds this. I mean, if you look at a photo, it just looks so saucy and glossy.
It's very seductive.
Mm-hmm. And it's sexy. The onions kind of drape along the beef.
What I love about onions like this, so you have like onion sort of cut into rings, it's that in between, they're not caramelized yet, but they're taking on a little bit of color. They still got like a body and a crunch to them.
Bite.
They're like
a
subtle crunch, but still soft and like, oh my God. And then the beef, and you've got some soy sauce and sesame oil. Ginger, yes, ginger.
Yeah,
yes.
A lot of ginger. I mean, you get a good amount of heat from the ginger.
Wow. And it says, a little caption on the photo. Make this when ... you need dinner on the table in less time than it takes to listen to a podcast. Andy Baragani and Chris Morocco, thanks for joining us. You can check out their story, The Fall Playbook, in the September issue of Bon Appetit on stands now. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Chris Morocco, you ready to do this?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Your top 10 cooking rules. Number 10, you don't have to follow a recipe.
Yeah, you really don't. I mean, and not even ours. And it breaks my heart to say that because obviously I write them and I think I do a pretty good job of it. But if something's going on in your world, in your kitchen, in your life, and like that recipe is about to go off a cliff, don't just cook it straight off the cliff. You know, like use your intuition, use your own judgment. If it looks like it's burning, maybe it's burning. You know, you know better than I do what's happening like in, you know, your, in the recipe as you're cooking it.
Like I know like my oven, for instance, and I got to get this fixed, but the top heating elements are overly hot compared to the bottom one. So oftentimes the top of a roast chicken or whatever will start to brown too much. And like, yeah, if it's browning too much, do something. Or a large pan is going to cook hotter than a small pan and type certain things. And yeah, I think we need to listen to our instincts.
Yeah, completely.
And also just in terms of ingredients, I think like if you don't like things super spicy, don't put the jalapenos in. If you hate cumin, don't put the cumin in.
Yeah, completely. I mean, you know, I think, and that's where like cooking a recipe more than once, that honestly will change, you know, your appreciation for a recipe. Like there's, you know, doing it the first time, that's great. But then when you come back and do it the second time and then you work in all those things, you know, like leave the cumin out, don't cook it quite so long. That's when it really becomes yours. And I think it becomes so much better.
It's like your final draft.
Mm-hmm.
Number 9, invest in decent cookware.
It kills me. You know, I go to IKEA for certain things, but I don't go there for cookware. And my thing is like, you see these like 13-piece sets advertised for like ridiculously, you know, small amounts of money. And the fact is like one thing that's going to last a long time is so much better and more valuable in the long run than, you know, like some massive set that has like 9 things you don't need.
Yeah.
A large stock pot, a skillet, a small saucepan. That's kind of it.
Yeah, I moved to New York in 1994. I still have some all-clad stainless steel basic saute pans and a stock pot that I got 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And you have to think of the investment that way, that these good pots, a Creuset, Staub, those sort of things, are literally going to last you a lifetime. And if you can scrap up the money, it's worth spending because you're going to have them forever and they're not going to fall apart.
Yeah. And anything that's like, you know, there's so much nonstick out there. Nonstick is not going to last a long time. It's not to say you shouldn't have any of it because I love my nonstick skillet. But if it's like looking all frayed and like it's gotten kind of like scratched up, like it's time to go. You can't be precious about it.
Whereas typically a cast iron pan, for instance, is going to get better over time.
Completely.
All right. Number 8. If cooking isn't fun for you, then do whatever it takes to make it fun. Explain.
Oh God, I was thinking about when both of our kids were really young, like a newborn baby and a toddler, like 2.5 years old, and I would come home and need to cook something, and that was like kind of a dark time in my life where cooking was not fun. It wasn't relaxing. It was just a means to get food on the table. And I would literally just like, I would like get my Netflix app going on my phone and I'd have like Bad Boys playing, you know, like on the corner of the counter, like real quiet. So my wife had no idea what was going on. And I would just kind of like zone out. So the point is, whatever it takes, a glass of wine, some good music, get yourself set up to enjoy it, you know, because like you shouldn't hate doing it. And if you do hate doing it, then like try something else.
Yeah, it shouldn't feel like a chore. We're not saying it's easy, but it should be enjoyable.
Yep.
Okay. I am guilty of not practicing this next rule. A cake tester is essential, just not for cake.
Yeah. For me, it is totally indispensable as a way of judging the doneness of fish in particular.
Explain what a cake tester is for those who don't know.
Yeah. So it's this really thin, stiff, kind of short length of wire attached to a little sort of plastic tab that you basically like you use the tab as sort of like your grip. So it allows you to poke this little skewer, this little metal skewer into things. And with a piece of fish, you can literally feel the pops of resistance in the layers of collagen in the fish when it's underdone.
Yep.
And you will feel the transition to the moment where that cake tester wants to slide right through the fish as that collagen is softening into gelatin. It allows you to gauge the temperature of things, like by sticking it in, leaving it for a few seconds, then pulling it out and touching it to the bottom of your lip, where you're very sensitive to temperature. For anybody who's like burnt their fingers multiple times, like it's just not a great way to you know, a great way to gauge things. And I'm just a huge fan of having it around, you know, just as a really quick way to kind of gauge doneness also of like vegetables. If you're sliding a paring knife into something, you know, a paring knife is sharp. Even a dull paring knife is sharper than a cake tester is. So if you're poking it into a carrot or a green bean to kind of gauge doneness, it's not really telling you much. Whereas like that cake tester, that blunt little kind of wire tip, feeling the resistance kind of, you know, and like gauging the resistance of like whatever vegetables, you know, or proteins you're cooking, it goes a long way.
And with cake, I assume what you're looking for is for the tester to come out clean, and that means the cake is baked through, correct?
It is, and but hilariously, you know, I prefer a like a wooden toothpick for a cake. You know, something that's just like a tiny, that's why I said it's a cake tester is essential, but perhaps not for cake.
Well, why,
you know?
Why a toothpick?
That wood exterior, that tiny bit of like abrasive likeness to the surface is gonna give you a better gauge on like whether there's like a wet crumb that's gonna kind of cling. The cake tester, it's so smooth, it kind of goes in and out a little bit too easily to a cake.
I feel like number six is similar in terms of not what you think you're gonna use them for, but you say keep a set of chopsticks around.
Yeah, we did a whole podcast episode about this, me and Carla, just about how useful they are as like a sort of small and nimble cooking tool. A wooden set of chopsticks, using it on your nonstick, it's not going to scratch it up. It, you know, it's not going to get you electrocuted if you go fishing for toast, you know, at 7 a.m. You know, like when you like drop a green bean, like right next to the flame, you know, when you're doing like a little stir fry and like, you're like, oh shoot, my tongs aren't going to fit in there. And then you're just watching that thing like slowly ignite over the course of like 10 minutes, you know, that's going to allow you to grab that right out. It's a great way to just like flip and turn, you know, kind of like small foods where tongs might kind of like rough them up a little bit too much. I also love a chopstick for also gauging the doneness of a braise. Again, like a paring knife, it's just going to stick right into things. A chopstick is going to kind of give you a little bit more tactile feedback.
Love it. Do you just, in terms of the ones you keep, are you just using basic wooden takeout ones, or do you have like fancy ones?
I have like fancy-ish ones that cost like $2. They have that like black lacquer on them.
But
you
still
know?
Wood.
But still wood.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fresh citrus. Oh, sorry. Number five. Fresh citrus is better than regular crappy vinegar any day. Plus, lime juice will still go perfectly well with olive oil on a salad.
I know Brad was talking about vinegar, you know, in his, so he got there first. So I'm not going to name names about of like vinegars that I love and be a vinegar evangelist here. But I will say this, bad vinegar is horrible. It's just horrible. And you are so much better off using lemon or lime juice like on your salad, you know, or on your roasted vegetables or whatever, than you are using like that bad $4 grocery store vinegar. And I think there's this perception that, oh my God, well, like, sure, maybe lemon and olive oil, but like, what about lime and olive oil? Like, is that going to fly? And like, yes, absolutely. Grassy, fruity, you know, oil from a fruit and juice from a fruit. That also grows on a tree, you know?
Years ago with Bobby Flay, and there was one salad dressing, which I make a lot, which I love it. There was like lime juice, olive oil, some honey, maybe a few spices in there. But
it's
really
so
nice,
simple and so good, and it absolutely works. So you were so much better off using a fresh citrus juice, you know, to bump up the acidity of something than a bad vinegar. Just ditch the vinegar.
Okay, number four. I love this one. Don't let anyone else tell you what delicious is.
I think that's so important. You know, I think a lot of people, like, especially when they want to know more about, you know, food and cooking, they don't trust their own taste buds. They don't trust their own instincts. You know, this plays into a lot of different issues. But in terms of what you find delicious, don't let anybody else talk you down. Like, the fact that you don't like anchovies, you know, we're not quite done, like, giving you crap for it.
I'm also, I come around on certain anchovy things. I'm working on it.
But it's been a multi-year process.
But I hear you. It's like, there's certain things that you, if you know you don't like something, don't feel like peer pressured into like, oh, have some. You're like, no, I'm good actually.
Yeah, I know that like, I hate bananas.
So
like,
do I.
It's like food for babies.
Yeah.
Letting people just enjoy what they want to enjoy is huge. And sometimes I have to tell myself this when I watch my kids dip everything into ketchup.
I mean, I think there should be one stipulation for this, is that we are talking about adults here. I think as parents, we're trying to at least get our kids to try a lot of things so they can then decide whether or not they like something. But I think once you're a full-grown human being, you kind of often know what you're into or not into. You know. But I think, yeah, kids is kind of a whole different thing.
Oh, completely, completely.
Number three, this, I feel like you can go a lot of places with this one, so please do. But go big on flavor.
Yeah, I was just thinking about how 10 years ago, I was not using tahini or miso. I was not using gochujang. I was not using many hot sauces. Mm-hmm. I was not using a lot of ingredients that were the product themselves of kind of long, you know, fermentations or kind of like flavor development. Soy sauce is like such a great example of this. And I think here's the point I want to make. It's that you, just because you use a little bit of miso in your chicken soup doesn't necessarily turn it into miso soup. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it just turns it into a way more flavorful soup than you had before. Putting a little gochujang on, you know, your pork skewers that you're about to grill outdoors, like, doesn't necessarily like turn it into a different dish than you were intending. It's just like, these are one-stop shops for adding tons of flavor to your food. And they can do it in, you know, overt and very obvious ways, or they can do it in very subtle and stealthy ways.
I think it's also kind of builds momentum. Once you start cooking with some of these ingredients, as you said, ones that have been fermented or aged that bring that punch, that umami, you develop much more, not just a tolerance, but a desire for them.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That you, and so then everything you cook, you're looking for that little extra snap. You're like, oh, what can I add to this just to hop it up a little bit more?
Yeah, completely. And you find ways to use these things that kind of blow your mind. Like, you know, putting like hot sauce just into a vinaigrette and then putting that on, you know, like fruit or like cut up like summer, you know, like when we were doing for like savory fruit salads, all of a sudden like transforms things, you know?
I've never done that before.
Oh, yeah. Wow. A little hot sauce vinaigrette.
Emma,
oh,
you've done
time.
That? No, she's like, not me.
Oh my
okay.
God, where have you guys been?
not reading Bon Appetit, apparently. Sorry about that. Number two, mise en place isn't just about food and equipment.
Oh, yeah. There's that temptation, like, when you get home to just, like, start cooking.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're right. I'm in a rush.
I got to do this. And it's like, you know what? Maybe you're better off spending 4 minutes going to the bathroom, getting your head in the game, putting some music on, and, you know, cracking open some seltzer or pouring yourself a glass of wine, because that feeds back into that idea of like, you need to make this fun for yourself. Mm-hmm. This should not just be about getting from A to B. You will be a better cook for enjoying the process, you know, kind of all along the way. So mise en place, just that concept of like organizing yourself, organizing your station, you know, having everything in its right place. I think it applies to you too.
All right. Your number one cooking rule, which I feel is a rule that professional chefs will constantly tell us, and I think us home cooks rarely practice, taste your food.
Oh, this is my number one. Like, if you could like teach the world. What blows me away is that people are always asking me to taste something that they've made, asking for my opinion, but that they themselves have not yet tasted.
Yeah.
My wife does this all the time. She'll say, like, what do you think? How's it tasting? I'm like, I don't know. What does it taste like to you? And she's like, I don't know. I never taste while I cook. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And, you know, and people will give me crap in the kitchen and videos and stuff, because I've literally got like half a cutlery shop's like worth of spoons banging around in my pocket, you know, making me like walk like with a limp, you know. But I don't know any other way but to just be tasting things all the time.
So taste as, not just right before you serve it, but as you're making the sauce, as the braise is coming together.
As you're cooking, tasting for those moments, you know, like where flavors are changing in a recipe, like where a canned tomato goes from being like that kind of raw, tinny, kind of like bell pepper, like vegetal kind of tomato to like, ooh, jammy, concentrated. Yeah. Umami.
It's that rush sort of thing while we're cooking. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've like made pasta for 4 people and I'll bring it to the table and I'll serve it and I'm like, oh, this needs salt. And I'm like, why didn't I taste it before I brought it to the table? And all I needed to do was add a little bit of salt and stir it in.
Yeah.
And then I had to tell everyone at the table, everyone should, here's some salt. You should put some salt on top. I'm like, why did I just taste that? And like, I do it all the time and I always kick myself. And I just, all right, now I'm going to say this is Chris's number one rule. Got to make it happen. Chris Morocco, thank you very much.
Thanks, Adam.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.